Future-Proof Extra from Newstalk.
When we think about the word culture, we often imagine human activities, architecture, dance, song, film, and so on. But we also know animals have a type of culture too. They use tools, they dance, they sing, some even teach. But there's more. It turns out that animals also separate out, even within a species, based on how they like to do things and form their own distinct cultural groups. Here to tell us why that could be a really big thing for the theory of evolution is Professor Carl Safina. He's from Stony Brook University and has written a new book called Becoming Wild. He joins me now. You're very welcome, Carl. I hope you're keeping well.
I am keeping well. So far, so good.
So tell me, what is this book, Becoming Wild, about?
It's about cultures that other kinds of animals, non-human animals, have. And it turns out that there are many kinds of animals that have culture. And what I mean by culture is what you learn from elders, not the things that come to you entirely instinctively.
Yeah. And I suppose when lay people like myself think about animals and this idea of culture, we sort of homogenize all groups. And one of the big points of your book is that within a species, even in a specific location, there are groups that separate themselves out, and physiologically they're the same, but they are different families that practice different behaviors that you can only really call culture, because it's not an adaptation in an evolutionary sense of the word.
Yes, that's exactly right. So now, even though I said it's not culture like humans have, it's culture like they have, what starts to become very apparent is that the dynamics of culture are really rather similar. And in the case that you're referring to, this is one of the major things that I realized as I was doing this research in the field, watching these animals and writing the book and reading a lot of literature that informs the subject, is that the culture of many different species causes individuals to form groups. This is something that happens in humans too. Just think of language or national symbols like flags. It causes individuals to form groups. It also causes the groups to avoid one another. They either avoid one another because there's a certain sense of hostility and competition among the groups, or because the groups do not know how to communicate and interact with one another. This is true of non-human groups that do things differently. And by analogy, the easiest way to understand what I'm talking about is in human groups, where two different groups of individuals may have two different languages, it's very hard to interact with somebody who doesn't speak your language.
And yeah. So, can you give us some case studies of some of the research that's come out that really highlights that? I mean, not just chimpanzees, I believe that's the case in whales as well, that there's sort of, they speak a certain language, but biologically they're the same.
Yes, biologically they're the same. And so an implication of this is that the groups that avoid each other strictly for cultural reasons achieve what amounts to reproductive isolation while living in the same place. This is something that when I was a graduate student, I was told is not possible.
And cultural selection, you call it.
Yes. So it is what amounts to cultural selection. Darwin identified natural selection as the way that, because not all individuals can live and survive, there are limited resources. So the environment sort of is a harsh and impersonal filter that winnows through individuals, and that's the main thing that Darwin identified as a way that the environment helps to sort of force the diversification of living things. But that didn't account for everything. He noticed, for instance, that many male birds are much more colorful than females. Well, the environment doesn't do that. The environment may be the reason that a female peafowl, a peahen, is camouflaged so that predators don't see her, but it doesn't explain why the peacock is incredibly lavishly colored. So Darwin came up with the other observation, which is that there is sexual selection. This is a really intentional thing that often females do. They select the ones that they like the best, and that sets up a competition among males to, you will only get chosen if you are more exaggerated and brighter than the one next to you. So that's where life is actually selecting life in a very intentional kind of way. The thing that neither of these exactly got to was, how do new species form? Natural selection says new species form when groups of individuals reach a place of no return. Most typically and famously, different groups of small birds reaching islands in the Galapagos archipelago where they can't get back. And so under slightly different selective pressures, they are under different trajectories, and they eventually change enough to be different species. But I was told this can never happen as long as the populations are in the same geographic region. And it turns out that not only is that not a satisfying answer, because of the tremendous amount of diversity that we do see, like on coral reefs or many small songbirds that are very closely related, that really don't have barriers, like mountains or rivers are not barriers to them. So how did they diversify? How did they become reproductively isolated? And the answer appears to be, and I believe it is, and I think that the documentation now in the science literature certainly supports this, is that this cultural tendency to learn a group identity, use it to do certain things in certain ways, and that makes it hard for groups to interact, makes groups avoid each other, that this is a new kind of selection that adds to natural selection and sexual selection. And it is cultural selection that creates this isolation that sets different groups onto different trajectories and causes biological diversification.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense to me. Is that an easy thing to prove in the research?
It's been shown in enough studies that I think the research is completely convincing on this point. It's been shown in fish, for instance. It's been shown in birds. It's been shown even in some insects, where young ones watching who adults will choose as mates and what counts as an attractive other individual depends a lot on simply what they see before they become active breeding individuals themselves. So, for instance, there are experiments where certain fish, cichlid fish, that live in these lakes where there are like 1,000 species of very closely related fish, they're all stuck in the same lake. So something is going on there to cause this diversification. Hmm. And in experiments, what they did was they took the young ones of one species and they switched the apparent parents. In other words, they just switched the parents and the young so that parents were raising individual babies of the wrong species. Yeah. And when those babies grew up, who did they choose as mates? They chose the individuals of the species that raised them. Right. So that's the way that they learn. It's strictly a learned thing. It's not biological, not instinctive. Who counts as sexy? Who counts as a good partner? In birds, you can do the same experiment. It's been done. Also in birds, we see that individuals singing a local dialect are appealing to local females, but birds singing a different dialect are avoided by local females. So this is what dialect you sing is learned. You learn it in the nest by listening to your father singing and the other males in the neighborhood singing. So the song dialect is strictly cultural, and yet it has real implications for who you will breed with when you grow up. With little finches called zebra finches in captivity, they've done similar experiments where they'll do something like glue a colored feather to the head of one of these little finches. And the ones that are raised with finches with artificially glued on colored feathers, that's what they want to mate with when they grow up. This is strictly a culturally learned thing. and it results in reproductive choice and therefore reproductive isolation among groups living in the same place. Another thing that when I was a graduate student, I was told is impossible is that the idea of a group identity, having, you know, identifying yourself as a member of a group was I was told, a distinctly human thing. It turns out it's not at all. And in fact, the sperm whales that I was studying and that I wrote about, they form these groups that are called clans. The clans will, individuals in a clan will all socialize, but the clans will avoid each other. They travel differently. They travel at different speeds. They hunt a little differently. And one thing that I think is really amazing is that the only two species on Earth in which an individual can tell whether a total stranger is a member of their group or not is a human being, because we have group markers like language or uniforms or things like that. So you can tell if a stranger is in your group or not, and sperm whales can tell if a stranger is in their group or not, because they have these patterned clicks called codas that announce who they are as individuals, what family they belong to, and what clan their family is in. And they can communicate that with total strangers and know, therefore, whether they can socialize with them or avoid them.
What about teaching? We also used to think that teaching a skill from parent to child was something that only humans do. Is that something that features a lot in the culture of chimpanzees, parrots, or whales?
Well, yes and no. So there's learning, and there's learning by observation, and there's teaching. Those are two different things. Teaching is when you take time away from what you're doing to actually show another individual what to do. Humans certainly do a lot of teaching. It turns out that there are a number of other animals that do teach. You can sometimes read that chimpanzees do not teach, that everything they learn is learned by observation. But there are documented instances of chimpanzees stopping what they're doing, helping a young one, breaking a tool in half and giving it to a young one, those kinds of things. Cats of various kinds teach. They teach by bringing back prey that is still alive and releasing it so that the young ones can catch it. Dolphins do very similar things. Otters drag babies underwater to teach them how to swim. That's not a baby just following the mother. They sometimes have to, you know, the mother sometimes has to stop and turn around. Turns out with sea otters, the young ones learn, not clear how much teaching is involved in this, but they learn from their mothers what their mothers eat and how they catch what they eat. And they don't eat everything that's edible or everything that even sea otters in the area are eating. They don't, like, the individual mothers teach their children a subset of what is available as food that becomes their particular diet. So there's a lot of learning by observation, and there's a lot more teaching than had been previously recognized.
Presumably, this sort of cultural diversity only happens in, I suppose, numbers where that's possible. If you have six sperm whales on the planet, presumably they'd be able to get over the fact that one speaks French and one speaks Spanish to mate. When you're talking about those otters, presumably that's because they have such widespread choice that they can choose what they eat like we do. But if you took those same otters and reduced the availability of the food, presumably they would adapt pretty quickly, right? So this culture is born from wealth.
As you keep repeating, that is a presumption.
Right.
And what has actually been shown is that culture gets lost as group size decreases. It gets lost much faster than genetic viability gets lost.
Yeah.
So when you have animals that are living in tiny fragments, a lot of the cultural knowledge is already gone, even though all other things equal, which they're not, the group size would allow them to recover. But where populations have been wiped out, certain parrots in certain areas, like a thing called the thick-billed parrot that lives in Central America, northern part of Central America and southern U.S., wiped out. They had a captive population. They tried to reintroduce them. They never could learn what food is, and the reintroductions failed. When they took things like bighorn sheep or some other ungulates to reintroduce them, they didn't know where the summer feeding range is and where to go in winter when the summer range turns brutal.
Yeah.
They did a lot of milling around and a lot of starving to death, and it took several generations before the survivors reconstructed a culture where they knew where things were and where to go. But they found all of that by trial and error at the cost of a lot of mortality.
Mm.
So what your presumption is only partly right. They don't do it quickly. And in the case of those thick-billed parrots, it wasn't done at all. It's a slow process. The learning of these things, what counts as food, where it is, how to get it, was done over a very long period of time, acquired by the species and by individuals that moved into new regions and learned the basic thing that culture answers, which is how do we live here? And when that is lost, it doesn't just come back quickly all the time. There are many instances where it has taken a long time and at the cost, as I said, of a lot of individuals dying.
What was the most surprising cultural practice you came across reading through the literature in preparation for this book? Was there something that you saw something that was so undeniably cultural and so surprising, given the species or given the activity, that it really made you pause?
Well, I think it was two things, and it came to me in the course of being in the field with the scientists, talking to them, and then reading a lot of the literature afterwards. And it was two things that we talked about already. It was the fact that sperm whales, well, that quite a few animals have a sense of a group identity, what group they belong with, and that sperm whales can recognize what group total strangers are in and whether they are in their group. And the idea that groups cause individuals to come together, I mean, that's the definition of a group. But what did surprise me was that culture causes the groups to actively avoid each other. And the evolutionary implication of that came to me kind of as a thunderbolt. It was one Sunday afternoon when I was writing here in my studio, right where I'm talking to you at this very writing table. And when I realized that this means reproductive isolation within the same region, even as these groups transit the same areas, the evolutionary implications of that actually were sort of so shocking to me that the hair on my arms went up. It, among other things, it answered a question I've been trying to puzzle out for the last 35 years since I was a graduate student, which is, you know, if animals cannot diversify into other species while they're in the same place, how in the world are there 1,000 species of cichlids in one African lake? How are there over 100 species of warblers in North America where, you know, they mingle in the treetops, they fly over the ocean in their migrations? I don't see any barriers to them. How did they diversify? And same thing with butterfly fishes and trigger fishes on coral reefs. I just could never believe that there was enough time and enough real barriers for them to diversify only because some of them were stuck isolated somewhere. It just did not seem real enough to me, but I didn't have another mechanism. And I think cultural selection is the mechanism that allows diversification in the same region at the same time.
And it also allows you to speed up the clock of evolution if I'm not wrong, because if we think of adaptation to an environment being just the production of sexual selection and natural selection, then you've got to almost roll the dice over and over again to see what pressures will develop what attributes. Whereas if it's a chosen behavior, it's almost like a decided journey down a particular path because of the environment, but also because of the behavior, which surely would speed up that physiology matching the environment.
Well, that's true, and that's very perceptive of you. We tend to think of culture and genetics as opposite things, but not only do the genetics facilitate culture, like I was saying about we have a genetic ability to learn a language, but what language we learn is cultural. So there the genes sort of come first and create the capacity. But when you have different cultures of killer whales where some eat only mammals and some eat only fish, well, a seal or a sea lion is a much tougher customer than a salmon. And the need to have bigger teeth, more robust jaws, comes after you start to specialize on these bigger, tougher prey.
Mm.
So sometimes culture leads and genes have to catch up with it. And that seems to be actually what has happened with killer whale types in the, well, in, at least in the Pacific Northwest, off the US and Canada. But killer whales are extremely interesting in this regard because they have many specialist types that do not mingle, do not socialize. And actually, if you look at their genetics, they have not interbred for hundreds of thousands of years. They do really match the definition of different species. They're different groups that never interbreed. That's what a different species is. They're not officially classified that way, but that's really what's going on with them.
Yeah. It's been brilliant speaking with you. Carl Safina, Professor of Nature and Humanity at Stony Brook and author of Becoming Wild. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. It's been a great honor and a lot of fun to talk to you.